Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay.
The call we pick up on May Day of 1978 is a few items I'd like to put on the record. That, I missed in saying that when I was in Delhi, the trade union, Indian trade union representatives were in the embassy for the first time. I didn't mean for the first time ever. Just during Ambassador Goheen's.
I see. I thought it implied.
No. I'm sure that they had been there before. I think I mentioned that in March of 78, the UAW group in China had been invited by me and came as my personal guests. It was an amusing interlude, which was reflective of the fact that at this time, early in 78, as the thaw began, Americans in particular began to use Polaroid cameras and broke down the resistance of the Chinese to having their pictures taken, because they could get on the spot a copy for themselves, which intrigued them until that time. As you know, you had to take pictures surreptitiously, pretending to take a tree when you were in fact taking individuals. Sharon and I were with the Great House group. They'd all come from Japan, where they were guests of the Japanese Automobile Workers Union, and of course they all got gifts, and they all got camera gifts. Each of them had a camera around his neck, not a Polaroid. And we were out, I think, at the Ming Tombs, and suddenly I see a PLA man posing for them, and I look, and they're all taking pictures, and figure, well, somebody's talked to him because he was posing quite happily. And I was still startled by this sort of thing because of the background of the previous few months. They all get through taking their pictures and begin to walk away, and he runs after them, shouting in Chinese and pointing at his mouth and sticking out his tongue and putting out his hand. He wanted his copy. And he was putting out his tongue to illustrate
how the picture
comes out of the Polaroid camera. And of course, what almost no Chinese I had was inadequate to the occasion, but luckily there was a Chinese woman there who spoke English. And she explained to him, and he still is remonstrating, and she just dismissed it. He walked away. Then I also note what I had missed on the last day of March in 78. We gave one of our periodic dinners for the officials of the Diplomatic Services Bureau, because our admin officer, Vickers, at the time, we used to do our diplomatic best to keep them attuned of our needs, and I think, on balance, it probably helped some. I also note that in early April...
You were still facing severe housing problems, though, for your staff.
Housing problems, it went to the question of personnel, it went to the question of needed small changes and so on. The DSB affected our lives in many, many ways. Housing was the biggest problem, but certainly not the only problem. Also, the question of bringing in goods through customs. DSB played a role in that sort of thing. And I know in early April, giving a reception for an alumni group, an administrative group from Stanford University. Even at that earlier time, Stanford was very busily working at reestablishing its relations.
This was John Lewis was very active in that.
John Lewis was very active in the program. He wasn't in this particular group. This was a vice president and leaders of their alumni association, but it was all part of it. It was a well-coordinated effort that Stanford had. And then on April the 13th, I note that I received Bertha Liu at the story. Right, and very soon in my tenure in the liaison office, I was instructed to raise with the Chinese the cases of three individuals who were, by American law, American citizens, but who probably, in fact, did hold dual citizenship, were also, in Chinese eyes, Chinese citizens, all in prison. There was Bertha Liu, Daniel Kelly, and I don't have readily at hand the name of the third person. And these cases were taken up on two or three occasions, beginning in the early fall of 1977, and Bertha Liu was the first to be released. She had the chance immediately to leave China, but she did not want to leave without her family. Her husband, who had also been more briefly in prison, she was in prison for 7 years, 4 months, and she knew exactly the number of days to the point she
was released. You might want to give the background of how she claimed her American citizenship. Do you recall?
Refresh my memory on that.
I don't remember that.
I think she was, as I remember it, I think she was born in the United States and taken back by her immigrant parents to China at a very young age. At this point, she was, as I remember it, 65. She had worked for many, many years in the British Embassy and was accused of espionage, and that was the purported reason that she was imprisoned. I'm quite sure she had American birth. And, of course, as far as the Chinese were concerned, since she was born of Chinese parents who then returned to China, and as far as she was concerned, she was a Chinese citizen. Daniel Kelly?
Mixed parentage, wasn't he?
Mixed parentage, yes. We did not in any of these cases challenge the Chinese citizenship. We were not making it a legal case that these people are citizens, and therefore we demand they be released. We were talking about the humanitarian aspects of the cases, and the fact that first with Bertha Liu in March of 78, they released her, and ultimately also agreed to allow her husband and daughter to go, was reflective, I think, of the beginning, further signal to us. And Daniel Kelly was released not too long after that.
As I recall, the Bertha Liu case antedated the Carter administration.
Oh, and yes.
Harry Thayer, as I recall, had spent time on this case when he was in Peking, and he brought a particular and very deep and humanitarian concern. This was a case in which he was humanly involved, as I recall.
Well, all three cases had been taken up before, and when I took them up, it was not for the first time that an American representative had taken them up. Even from the beginning, the Chinese did not question our right to bring them up or discuss them, and I think we had three meetings. All of them ended on we will investigate, we will take it up with the responsible persons, and so on. And we would let a period of time go by, and then I would go back and raise the question again. She spoke flawless English, and she was in China for some time because of wanting to wait for her family. And during the time she was there, we received a copy of the movie Star Wars to show. And John Tassick, our consular officer, took her to see Star Wars. That was probably a mistake because after her release, she had some physical problems, and Sharon was still the nurse, and so that she saw Sharon frequently, and they became close. And seeing Star Wars really shook her, because she was wondering what kind of a land she was trying to go to, seeing all these projects zooming out into space. But we were very happy when finally they were allowed all to leave. And the last we heard were doing quite well in the United States. Daniel Kelly, I never met Daniel Kelly except through American television. One of the times I was back in the United States, Daniel Kelly, I think, was on the Today Show. And as I remember it, whatever show it was, they were trying to push him into saying very negative things about the People's Republic of China, which he didn't do. And he probably had ample reason to do it, I'm sure. But he didn't do it, and I would someday like to talk to him and find out just why he was so objective when finally he was in the United States. The third man, unfortunately, I don't even at this point, as I say, remember his name. And, he was much after the event, but as I understand it, also was released. Whether in fact he came to the U.S., I'm not even sure. On May Day of 1978, my appointment book shows that Sharon and I went to the May Day celebration, which was held in the Workers' Stadium on the other side of town from the liaison office stadium, seating 18,000 people. Now, May Day of 1977, there had been fireworks displays in Tiananmen Square, and it was really in a huge banquet, I think, in the Great Hall of the People for the diplomatic community and others. This May Day was much more subdued than has been the pattern followed since. The parks had displays and games in for the young people and for the enjoyment of the families, but there was no fireworks display in the square. Budgetary reasons were given for not doing this, and that the celebration in the Workers' Stadium was really a variety show, very, very good show. And for the first time since the Cultural Revolution, classical ballet reappeared in China. I like to watch ballet. I'm certainly no expert, but to my untutored eye, they were quite good. In fact, I thought until I learned differently that they were French, who a visiting French group or a European group that had come, but they were. It was a Chinese ballet group, and to us at least, they were quite good. And that also was the first time I saw the two stand-up comedians who many,
Crosstalk.
Many times, right, appeared on Chinese television. We had seen them on television on a couple of occasions without knowing what they were talking about, but I remember the tremendous roar that greeted them when just their names were announced before they had said a word to each other. And they were tremendously popular with the Chinese. Star Wars at the International Club on May the 9th. That's when Bertha Leo, I think she went to on the next day. And it was also in May 1978 that we, an additional signal of a changing attitude on the Chinese part. When we opened the liaison office in May of 1973, and we were given the residence and the chancery that we took over, which, by the way, very small, as you know, you've seen it, we subsequently discovered was an exact duplicate of the embassy of Upper Volta, which kind of indicated where we stood on this, in the scheme of things. The only difference between Upper Volta and ours at this point in 1978 was we had had paid for the construction of an additional wing on the offices. We had outgrown it, and I think in 76 or so, taken over a floor of the high-rise apartment for foreigners in San Li Tun. And that was very cramped. And then just before I left for India in March, the DSB, that's probably why we gave them the dinner in April, told us we could, if we wished, rent a location bigger in as far as the office was concerned in square footage than the offices we had. It had been the Romanian Foreign Trade Mission, but the Romanians now had built a big embassy compound in which all of their activities were housed. And it was only less than a mile away from the official office, so that made it much more convenient. And of course, we took that, and needed not too much change. And we officially opened that with a flag raising on the 12th of May. I might say that we had a second wedding at the embassy, following the wedding of Sharon and myself. One of the secretaries married a representative at the Australian embassy. I just remember her now by her married name, Mary Firth. She had been the secretary of the year, not at the Peking station, but where she had been the year before. And so we had on the 5th of May, Sharon and I hosted a wedding dinner and reception for them. But they're not following our examples, because as far as I know, there have been no wedding since, and it's now almost 4 years. Then we come to the Brzezinski visit, about which you know more than I do in it, and I hope you will make this a duet at this point.
Fine. I'd be glad to join in.
As you know, on the Friday the 19th of May, I did the unusual thing of flying to Tokyo to join your group.
Right.
And this was upon urging of my colleagues in the State Department. I was staying at the residence, as was Zbig and his wife. And so I was taken to the residence after I arrived at Haneda. And
Sharon did not accompany.
Sharon did not come, no, because I was just going out and coming right back. And I had a session at 4:30, very shortly after my arrival, with Dick Holbrook and Bill Gleistein. Not upset about the visit anymore, but very much concerned about the fact that the plan was, as far as they knew it, when Zbig was to meet with the highest Chinese officials, there would only be three of us.
Oh, so that came up right away.
Zbig himself, you, and I. And that it was unthinkable that the Assistant Secretary for East Asia would be along and not be involved. And could I take this up with Dr. Brzezinski and see if something couldn't be done about it? But I was not to let on that I knew this. Certainly I was not to let on that I knew this from them. Well, I pointed out the difficulty that I didn't quite know how, if I couldn't say I knew about it, how I could talk about it. But it either was arranged or it had been arranged. I think it was arranged. There was an Mike Mansfield was, their ambassador, was having an Armed Forces Day reception at the residence. And just before that, Zbig was to have a session with me and suggested that he and, how's she pronounced the nickname? His wife.
Mushka.
Mushka. That, how about if we all went out to dinner, just the three of us? I said, fine. And then he said, you know, I used to live here, and there was a little neighborhood restaurant that we went to many times, that if you don't mind, we'd like to go back there. I said, that was fine. As a matter of fact, that little neighborhood restaurant cost $25 per person. So I'm glad we didn't go to any more pretentious place. So we went to the restaurant and talk about the visit in general terms. I'm wondering how I'm going to get to the point of raising the question that's been so urgently raised with me. When Zbig himself were sitting at, all this restaurant had was a counter, I think, with 10 seats, as I remember it, in a, bending around a corner with some 7 seats on one side and 3 around the corner. And we were sitting, I was sitting close to the door, and then Zbig and then Mushka. He raised the question about when we meet with Deng Xiaoping, he wants a very limited group, very limited number. And as it, I think, probably said, just 3. Just, he said, myself, of course, Mike Oxenberg, and you. And so the the ploy I took was, I'm afraid the Chinese would misunderstand if we had such a meeting without a representative of the State Department. Well, he said, you represent the State Department, don't you? And I said, well, frankly, I don't think of myself as representing the State Department. I think of myself as representing the President. And he was quite adamant. We went round and round on it. He was quite adamant. And I of course, I represented the State Department. That would be no problem with the Chinese.
Well, this goes back to, I don't think I've put on the record the, I don't understand, even now, the origins of the Brzezinski-Holbrooke relationship. They knew each other before coming to Washington.
I would imagine as editor of foreign policy, their paths would have crossed there.
That's right.
If not other places.
But I think it was clear to me from a very early day. Carter campaign, and I'm not sure whether it was the deep past or the Carter campaign past, but the two did not have what I would call a warm and intimate relationship from the outset. I know that Dick was worried about even the NSC state relationship and of the possibility of as big maneuvering as Kissinger had from the outset. The first time I met Dick Holbrooke, literally the first time, was going to Plains, Georgia to brief President Carter in that entourage that's big put together.
This is before the
election. Before the election and after he had been nominated. The second time I saw him was the day before the inauguration in January of 77. A typical Holbrooke, as I realized later, but did not realize at the time, he said that he thought we should have, he was delighted that I was joining his big staff, and he wanted just to have a chat with me, intimate chat, and I thought the two of us would sit down and we would have a conversation, but he married this girl, newspaper correspondent, TV correspondent, and she was there, and then he had a couple phone calls. It was a typical session with Dick Holbrooke that one did not have a chance for a sustained...
Even before he held office.
That's his operating style. So it was
a very
disconcerting breakfast. I wanted to have a serious talk, but he's a very, very sharp person. I did not even appreciate at that time how sharp. I had no idea when I entered government what the National Security Council did. As I mentioned in class the other day, I had never read much about the making of American foreign policy. But he knew what he wanted out of the breakfast, and he said that we both want to work for normalization, yes, we'll work closely together, yes. And he said, I want to make one commitment with you, one promise, that we will not keep any secrets from each other, that we will tell each other everything we know so that there's no rivalry between us. And I said, I thought that sounded like a good idea. And he said, let's shake on that. So I shook his hand. And I didn't know what I was promising, even. I thought it was an excellent idea. Well, on the Vance trip, I learned that he had not been totally candid with me on some things. And so I looked back on that promise, and I thought he had suckered me along. But in any case, there was this strained relationship between Zbig and Holbrooke, which was then exacerbated by what both Zbig and I saw as Holbrooke's efforts to limit, to make it more difficult for Zbig to go to China. He always claimed to me that he had not done that, but it smelled that way to both Zbig and myself. Then came what for me was one of the most painful moments in my whole time in government, and I do want this to be on the record. Zbig's instructions were not to discuss his trip at all in the State Department, but he wanted Dick Holbrook to be involved in the planning of it. This was at the time when we had already begun to schedule the trip. You will remember that before the second Panama Canal Treaty vote, Zbig's trip had already been scheduled, and we'd already begun to discuss the date of the trip, but it had not been made public. Zbig wanted no leaks, and in every administration, 1 year, 3 months into the administration, the people in the White House began to be very leak conscious. They were facing problems already on Iran, on some other things. And because of the nature of size negotiations on SALT with the Russians, particularly there, and because of all the difficulty in scheduling Zbig's trip, he didn't want any publicity given to it. So all of it was to be run out of the White House. Dick understood that. Then I went over to the White House, to the Monday meeting. You know, Dick Holbrook had this regular Monday meeting. And Dick sat down, and in front of Mort Abramowitz, who was then at ISA, and Mike Armacost, myself, you know, the regular Monday group, Dick says, well, we'll talk about Zbig's trip today, and I've invited Harry Thayer up to join us for the conversation. I look at him, and I don't say anything. I just shut my mouth like this, and he could see, and I sank lower in my chair, and I said, this places me in an impossible situation. And he says, well, Harry is already on his way up. And I said, I think you had best close the door. And so he shuts the door, and then the door was shut, and I said, I think you should ask him to go downstairs. So he says, all right, I'll go tell him go downstairs and come back in an hour. So something like that. My memory's a little hazy, but in any case, Harry was not called in. We discussed the rest of the meeting, then everyone left, and it ended up, and again, my memory is not clear, but it ended up, no one else was in the room but Dick and myself. The door was shut, and Harry was waiting on the outside to come in. And I said, I will not discuss this in front of Harry, or even in front of Bill, although I am sure that Bill will be fully drawn into the planning for his big trip. But my instructions from my boss at this time, and you know it, are that I'm not to discuss this.
Where was Armacost at this point?
He was on the NSC staff with me.
Mike
was fully involved in the plotting. Okay. I must tell you, I'll give you another story of the plotting that went on for Zbig's trip. It reminds me of another story. But so here was, this was, we were humiliating Harry Thayer. That's really what was happening, is we were humiliating Harry Thayer. And finally, I said, I will not discuss this with Harry. That is my instruction. And I've been placed in an untenable position. So
that explains Harry's attitude,
Dick,
subsequently.
Sure. So Dick said, well, all right. So he goes out, asks Harry to go downstairs. And then he comes back in, and I said, Dick, this is just unforgivable. And he says, don't tell Zbig about it. And I said, I've lost my temper. He said, I goddamn sure will. What do you mean, not tell him? You know exactly what the instructions were that we both were working on. So I went back. Zbig was getting ready to fly off to, with the president to, I think it was President Carter's crazy round-the-world trip. You remember he went to six countries in 4 days or whatever. Zbig was working late, and I came back. Yeah.
India.
India, not Poland, but India. It was Venezuela, Brazil, Nigeria, but India, and then Iran, touching in Iran the way back. I think that was that trip. I'm not totally certain. The record could tell us what trip it was. But in any case, I called Spig and I said, look, you're going to be gone for about 10 days. I'm going to be planning your trip. And I've just had this terrible, unpleasant situation. You got to call Dick and underscore to him what your instructions to me were, because I'm trying to, I am your staff person. So then, that was at about 7:30 at night. We tried to reach Dick. We couldn't. The next thing I know is I get a phone call at 6 o'clock in the morning, 6:30 in the morning, because Big is on his way to the airport. And he says, I took care of it. And you won't have any trouble. And he hung up. 3 minutes later, my phone rang, and it was Dick Holbrook on the end of the line. And he said, what did you tell Brzezinski? I said, well, I just told him what happened yesterday. And he said, I want you to know that you have subjected me to the most humiliating experience. I've never heard such a vile, profane man. This Big yelled at me over the phone so loud that it woke up my wife. It must have been one hell of a phone call. And he said, you're an intriguer, you know, a whole range of things. I said, look, all I want from you is that we'll be fully involved in the planning of the trip, but don't subject your staff to humiliation and say that I'm the source of the problem. So from then on, Zbig didn't trust Dick at all on the planning for his trip. But we drew Gleistein in, and Dick partly. But Dick's style of work, too, was, and it really was frustrating for me, in effect, day to day, to work with this guy. He has tremendous strengths, but he is such a political animal that he's very hard to pin down and to say, yeah, that's my responsibility. I will do it. Here's the position that I have on the issue. I believe in it. I'm responsible for it. There's always a slippery quality I felt there. So even in planning for this big trip, you couldn't get him to sign off on anything. It would be Bill who would take the responsibility, or it'd be lost somehow. But in any case, we got the planning for it, and I hadn't focused too much on who was going to attend. But Zbig had thought through that he didn't want Dick involved in the meetings, and he went to the president. Oh, and then Dick could see that this was coming, so Dick went to Tsai and pumped Tsai up on this issue. And Tsai and Zbig both went to the president on it. And the president said it's that he would prefer.
Yes, Zbig said at the dinner.
At the dinner that the president had said
when I
three
kept
people.
Pushing, when I kept pushing, he said, "Look, this is the president's wish."
That's right. The president said three people, and so the president had already, but Zbig had pumped the president and manipulated him. I think what Zbig understood at that time, and in defense is big in this, that what he wanted to do is be the person to bring the report of his trip home. And he wanted to be the one to report both to Tsai and to the president about the trip. And he wanted no one else to do the reporting. That, I will just go forward and end the story, but it is this that irreparably introduced tensions in my relations with Dick for the rest of the time. Because then, on the way back on the plane, Dick and I nearly got into a physical into a fight. Because we had the memcons. The memcons were written up. And then Dick wanted to see the memcons. And Zbig came to me and said, he is not to see them. And so...
Man in the middle.
Huh?
Man
so,
in the middle.
Well, what I did, though, is show them to Bill. And I showed Bill also my full analysis of what's... Because I wrote the draft of Zbig's report to the president, which he then edited. And I showed that to Bill, and I showed it to Mort, but I was under instructions not to show it to Dick. So they, I presume, could then fill him in. But then he said he wanted the memcons, and I said, no, you will see him after we get back. So I'll never forget this. I was on the airplane, and Dick became livid, absolutely livid. And I was violating the promise that I had given him before I went in. He grabbed me by my collar, and he said, if you don't give me those memcons after we get back, I will destroy you. And I said, and Dick, if I give those memcons to you after we get back and you violate our trust, I will destroy you. And so then he said, are you trying to threaten me? And then just walked away.
Well, that explains a lot of things.
But it was really very, it was, you know, in an academic is not prepared for that kind of stuff.
Well, we're going to have to break off now. That explains some conversations I had on the plane from Tokyo to Peking. With first Bill Gleistein, then Holbert and Gleistein with me, and finally Zbig came back after quite a lengthy interval, and put all that. We can start there the next time.
Oh, yes. Well, it's the party, the plane ride. It was, Zbig did not handle that trip well. He had a great capacity on that trip to bring that whole group he took over with him into his camp, in effect, and make them his people. And instead, he was very remote on that trip, did not work well with the rest of the group. He particularly could have done much more with Bill Gleistein, and who was a prince of a person. Just
Well, Bill felt very uncomfortable, and we can get into that
yeah,
next time.
Exactly.
Well, that's very interesting.